This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 261 was recorded on March 4th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Saxo Bank commodities guru Ola Hansen joins me as this week's feature interview guest. As we've discussed at length in recent weeks, a lot of our macro experts are telling us we're at the beginning of what could be an epic secular bull market in commodities as inflation expectations begin to take hold. So we're going to be bringing you more commodities experts in coming weeks, starting with Ola Hansen this week. We'll discuss everything from the macro drivers of the move higher in commodity prices to where the best opportunities exist and how to trade them. Then be sure to stay tuned for our postgame segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled Markets Get Wobbly.
And I'm Patrick Serezna now. Eric, the S&P 500 started Monday with a big update. It looked like the bulls were back in control. And here we are breaking to a fresh weekly low. On the downside, we're trading or closing right around 3770 on the S&P here. What's your take on this?
Well, boy, Patrick, two whole weeks and no new all-time high. And the crazy part, or what really makes me think, is the number of people who are freaking out because we've gone for two whole weeks without a fresh all-time high in the stock market. The thing is, at least until today, this really didn't look to me like a blow-off top or, you know, the sky is falling or the market's crashing or anything. In fact, it really looked to me like the 50-day moving average once again was going to be the buy-the-dip moment. The market was set to reverse. All we had to do was get through a little bit of a speech from Jay Powell, and as soon as that was behind us, the sky was clear for up, up, and away. Guess what? Jay Powell must not have said the right thing. I had my eyes glued to the crude oil market today because we had an OPEC Plus meeting, so I didn't tune in for Jay Powell's press conference. But boy, by the time it was over, it wasn't the 50-day moving average the market was flirting with. It was closer to the 100-day. Patrick, you listened to Jay Powell today live. What happened?
Well, the market did tumble over 100 S&P points in the period right afterwards, and definitely the market is showing a little bit of a wobble, and we'll talk more about it in the postgame. Really, up until this meeting, the story of this entire market correction has been just rotation, which is until today, we had energy, cyclicals, financials, value, all going higher, while the tech sector, particularly the FANG stocks, all were very heavily distributed. And that was the case. But then really, today in the afternoon, in the post-speech period, the market really started to get nervous. We saw some more panicky selling. And, you know, the thought that came to me was that there's that old adage that the market stops panicking when central banks start to panic. And I think that Powell really was saying they're not worried too much about things. They're not worried about yields where they are. They're not too worried about where the markets are at. And I think that actually is somewhat concerning the market because it means that the Fed is not going to backstop it anytime soon. And I think that that's maybe contributing to this volatility. One way or another, I'd love to talk about it with some charts in the postgame. Anyway, let's move on to the U.S. dollar here, because really started to move higher in this period right after the speech. We're back to where we were last week. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Well, to me, the key of what you said is back to where we were last week. So, okay, we came down some and came up some. Still, there's no change. We're consolidating in a range between 89 and 92, and we're not even close to 92. So, you know, wake me up when we get a closing print outside of that range. Until then, we're trading sideways until further notice. And so I don't think there's really any reason to, you know, there's been a lot of rhetoric in the market, it seems like, people saying, oh my gosh, look at all the strength in the dollar, strength in the dollar. It's back up to where it was a couple of weeks ago. It's not a big deal. We need to see a closing print above 92 before there's any meaningful technical message as far as I'm concerned. Until then, my general comment on the dollar is, remember, even though there are very strong fundamentals to say that fiat currency gets debased, the dollar is measured by the dollar index relative to other fiat currencies. So it's not really an indication of the dollar's weakness. It's only an indication of the dollar's weakness relative to the euro and other currencies.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, because we started the week with a little bit of weakness. We dipped temporarily below 60, and then OPEC. And boy, what a day we had today. I'm dying to find out what you think happened here.
Well, there were two big stories this week, so let's take them separately. The first one was earlier this week, rumors were leaked that OPEC was mulling an increase in production. Now, this is just a page out of the OPEC playbook. It's what some people call a trial balloon. What really is going on is OPEC wants to test what the market reaction would be if they were to increase production. So they leak a story to a journalist saying that's about to happen, and they see what the market does, and they know that they can always go the other direction at the meeting if they want to. So that happened earlier. We got almost $5 down in the price of crude oil. Not really a big deal. It was the first time, or not the first time, it was about the third or fourth time since the 1st of November that we got two closing prints below the short-term moving averages in a row. That's only happened a few times since the beginning of November, and that would normally indicate the beginning, potentially, of a more significant correction. But just like the last couple of times, the 21-day moving average caught the market. Then what happened was, when the meeting actually happened, they didn't increase production, and the rhetoric in the meeting was very much in the opposite direction. They opened by emphasizing the need for caution and prudence and so forth. A lot of words kind of saying, we need to wait this out. Now, I have a theory here, and this is definitely conjecture on my part, but I think that what the OPEC Plus people are doing is they're looking at exactly the same technical number I'm looking at and saying, boy, if you could engineer a breakout past 65 spot 65 and sustain it, there's just not a lot of resistance above, and you could potentially launch an epic rally that could really, really start to pick up some steam here, especially with the inflationary backdrop. I think that OPEC did an intentional head fake with this trial balloon. They kind of hinted that they might go the other direction. They let the market absorb and sort of shake off that news. Then they went and surprised everybody with a push in the opposite direction, I think hoping to take out 65 spot 65 to the upside. And they almost got there. We got to 64 spot 87. So we're less than a dollar away now from what would be more than a two-year high, I think, if we can take out 65 spot 65. I think what they're doing is they're waiting to increase production until after that breakout really gets going. And let's say we're up to $70. And at that point, they can start increasing production. That's just my guess as to what may be going on behind the scenes. Then the next big event was inventory, which came in at 21.6 million barrels. That is the largest recorded build on crude oil inventory ever in the history of the market. That caused a whole bunch of people who don't understand how the market works to completely freak out. In reality, it was no big deal and entirely expected. Yes, there was 21.6 million barrels of oil that was added to inventory this week. Why? Because 23 million barrels, a larger number, was drawn down from distillates. Why is that happening? It's entirely about the Texas freeze-out. What's occurring here is a bunch of refining capacity was shut in due to the freeze-outs, and that means that you draw down the inventory of finished products, and the crude oil piles up because you're not able to process it because the refinery is shut down. It's not really a surprise. What you care about is the net number, which is a drawdown, not a build, of 1.7 million barrels of petroleum products overall, including both crude oil and finished products. So it's really not this panic bearish number that a lot of people in the media were claiming it was. So crude oil build 21.6,
Cushing, Oklahoma, a much smaller build of 485,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 13.6 million. Distillates drawing down 9.7 million. Again, that's a net drawdown of 1.7 million barrels. So whenever there's a weather event, what happens is it really just makes the inventory data essentially meaningless. We use inventory data in order to figure out trends in markets. There's no trending information from a disrupted market where a shut-in of both producing assets and refining capacity has completely corrupted the numbers. So the numbers really don't mean anything when this happens, but they still freak people out because it was the biggest build in recorded history. U.S. production up 300,000 barrels. Sounds like a lot, but actually that's just the beginning of a recovery. Remember, it was down well over a million barrels last week. So from down 1.3 million, we're down to down 1 million from a few weeks ago at 10 million barrels even. Again, this is all about the Texas freeze out that has caused this. So again, my next technical target, as I said before, is 65, spot 65. I won't be surprised if we take that out sooner than I previously expected. I think last week I said, you know, that's just such a formidable resistance level. Surely we'll have a few weeks, if not months, of consolidation before we take that level out. My spidey senses, Patrick, say that might come sooner than we expect. And that mostly, that opinion is driven by my interpretation of what OPEC appears to be trying to do. Art Berman, when we had him on as our very first feature interview guest in 2021, he said $65 by the end of the year, and we got all kinds of feedback from listeners who said, Art's crazy, that number's too high for 2021. Well, look, it's the 4th of March. We almost got there today. We were within 13 cents of it. I think that a new all-time high, that means more than $147 a barrel, is entirely possible, if not likely, by, let's say, the end of 2024, in the next few years. A lot of people said that was just such a crazy event in 2008. You know, it'll be at least 15 years before we ever see prices like that again. Okay, 2008 plus 15 equals 2023, just about on schedule. Time spreads, meanwhile, are to the moon. My favorite spread, Z1, Z2, broke 450 today, 4 spot 55, as I look at the tape as we're recording here. So fantastic performance there.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold really, there's nothing else to say other than it's been outright distributive. Every rally fails. It keeps breaking to lower lows. The trend is decisively down, but inevitably a buy and dip will happen. How low does it go, though, before we see a buying opportunity here?
Well, Patrick, the only thing that surprises me is how many people seem to be surprised by this. It's very much in line with my own expectations and what we've described here on Macro Voices in the last several weeks, which is, although I'm still very bullish long-term on where we're headed, there's just no good reason to expect anything other than more weakness and more downside so long as 10-year real yields are increasing, which they are. So I'm already buying both bullion and mining shares down at these prices. Note particularly, though, that today we hit 1688 was the low on the April contract. Listen for that number again in this week's feature interview with Ola Hansen. He's going to describe that as a really important technical level that needs to hold. That means there's an argument that this could have been a bottom today. But what Ola's telling us is if we get daily closes below today's low, that really could mean that there's a whole lot more downside coming. And frankly, that wouldn't surprise me at all. I think another $100 to $200 of downside is entirely possible here. And frankly, I hope it happens. I would love to buy more gold $200 lower.
All right, well, let's move on to that 10-year Treasury yield. We're above 1.5%. It certainly wasn't Powell's speech that talked the yields down. Do you think we are going still much higher here?
Well, I think there was a lot of expectation in the market that Powell's speech would include at least a hint toward Operation Twist version 3.0 or whatever, however many Operation Twists we're up to. And for anyone who's not familiar, Operation Twist means the Fed intervening to bring up the rates at the front end of the curve while suppressing the rates at the back end of the curve. And there was a lot of expectation that they were about to announce that. I didn't watch the Powell conference today myself, but I'm assuming just from the market reaction that that did not get promised today. And I think that probably has to do with what's going on here. So the question really is, when does the Fed step in? And a lot of people thought it was going to be today with Jay Powell's speech. I guess it wasn't. We're going to have to find out. But that's the real question, is how far does the Fed let it go? Because I think the fundamentals are in place for yields to keep on backing up until there is some kind of intervention. When is it coming? How far do they let it go? And what do they do? That's really what remains to be seen.
This week's feature interview guest is Saxo Bank Commodities Chief Ole Hansen. Now, Eric, why did we invite Ole back on the show this week?
Well, Ole is one of my favorite commodities guys in the whole world. I really enjoyed interviewing him back when we used to do the Energy Week podcast. And he's also had some remarkably accurate price levels on gold. He called that 1762 cycle low to the penny, to the mark, when that happened, what was it, a month or so ago. And now his next call in terms of a level, which he'll mention in this interview, happens to be almost exactly where the low print was today. So he's a very, very accomplished guy. I almost feel like inviting him back for another interview, because today's interview was recorded a couple of days ago on Tuesday. And I think you'll see that he's predicted a lot of what has happened in the last couple of days. I'd love to get an update from him. Maybe we'll have to bring him back in a few more weeks.
Well, Eric's interview with Ole Hansen is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies, which also sponsors my new Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how the markets themselves could be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. My interview with John Goldstein, Sustainable Investing Chief for Goldman Sachs, is available now at smartermarketspod.com. My guest on Smarter Markets this coming Saturday morning will be Bill Pezos, co-founder of Air Carbon Exchange, a man who's doing what Jeff Curry was the most important thing we need to do, putting a price on carbon. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to separately subscribe to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this free new podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ole Hansen, head of commodity strategy for Saxo Bank. Ole has prepared a slide deck in association with today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button above Ole's picture and right below the green donate button that says looking for the downloads. Ole, it's great to have you back on the podcast. Boy, commodities, kind of forgotten, it seems, by most people in the macro world for the last few years. And all of a sudden, whammo, it seems as if the commodity sector overall has bottomed and reversed quite vigorously. Would you agree with that assessment? And how would you describe the macro drivers? What's going on here? Is it just a bump? Is it a dead cat bounce? Or are we really seeing a secular return to a commodity bull market?
Well, hello, Eric, and thank you very much for having me. You're absolutely right. I've been covering commodities in my current role for the past decade, and definitely the last 6 months, I haven't seen so many requests from clients looking for how to get exposure to the market. So it's obviously something that's suddenly attracting a lot of attention. And I think rightfully so, because I think in order to understand where we are today, we obviously have to go back exactly almost a year to the peak of despair when the pandemic started more or less a year ago. We saw a massive collapse in demand, obviously primarily hitting the oil sector. We saw producers step in to support the price, and that really set the oil market on a recovery trend. If you look at the agricultural space, we've seen China re-emerging on the buy side, or accelerating their buying of key products such as soybeans and corn. They obviously had a hog herd that was decimated a couple of years ago. That's now rapidly being rebuilt, and they need massive amounts of corn and soybeans in order to do that. So that helped as well. And then as we moved into the year, we were once again presented with a massive amount of stimulus, coordinated race to the bottom by central banks around the world, led by the majors, US and Europe, Japan, the UK. And suddenly money was basically for free and stimulus was coming. And again, we've seen the market react, suddenly starting to increase and to look for reflation and look for inflation hedges. And I think there's a key time, if you look over the past year, that was basically beginning of November. We had the first vaccine announcements, and also we had Joe Biden winning the election in the US. That kind of turbocharged the whole decarbonization theme, green transformation, and we've seen some of the commodities respond to that as well. Because we do have to remember that in order to turn green, we cannot turn green without many of these key raw materials. So I think on the just to look at some of these amazing gains we've had on slide 3 in the deck, we've seen that these performance since early November, as I mentioned, and as you can see, we just basically got broad gains. Basically, apart from precious metals, and I think that's the one that stands out, because, and the one I think that surprised many, because if part of the rally was driven by reflation, then why on earth has gold done as poorly as it has? And I think in order to understand that, we need to see that recent yield spike that began back in January and which accelerated last week. It's simply a period that gold is struggling to put up a defense against. But generally, we're looking for stimulus. We're looking not only for banks to be supported over the coming years. We're looking for governments increasing to step up their spending, and that basically means a lot of money will flow into infrastructure and into the hands of consumers, and that will continue to lead growth in the market. And then just finally, I think very importantly as well, one thing is that we're seeing expecting a pickup in demands, some of which we're seeing already, but also we're coming out of a decade where, as you mentioned at the beginning, commodities have really not been in vogue. It's not been a sector where investments have gone to. People have been piling in money into the technology sector as well. And that basically leaves us with several of these markets, key markets, with underinvestments, and therefore also the risk of that we see supply basically not keeping up with demand over the coming years.
I find it very interesting, given the narrative that at least I perceive in the market. It's really about stimulus, and of course, green energy is a big priority of the Biden administration, and definitely infrastructure build-out. That would say to me, okay, infrastructure build. I would expect the metals and industrial commodities to be the strongest. I would have expected the agriculture to kind of lag behind them, because the story's not really about agriculture. It's more about government spending on infrastructure and particularly the focus on green energy. But boy, look at the grains and the softs in your chart here on page 3. They're the only things that energy is the only thing that's outperforming grains and softs. Any explanation or insight as to what's going on there?
Yeah, I think we have to boil that down to China, Chinese demand, and weather. We've basically come out of, we've had 4 or 5 years where crop production around the world has been relatively unharmed by all the potential risks from climate change, especially in some of the key production areas in Russia, in the US, and in Southern America. And that started to change last year. We saw several moments of worries, which was related to the production, but then clearly the massive amount of buying that came in from China also did its part. So the rally has been driven by primarily corn and soybeans, and this is really the bad type of inflation, because that's the one that hurt the one that can afford it the least. I mean, we are already now seeing countries starting to complain about rising inflation, rising food costs, and just last month when we saw a spike in wheat prices after Russia introduced export taxes on the wheat in order to maintain local supplies and keep domestic prices down. We saw wheat prices come within, I think it was within 10%, probably less than that, of the peak we had in back in 2011. And obviously that was the one that partly led to the Arab Spring, where we had the food crisis in several countries. So it is a, we come from out of years of plenty suddenly into a market where we see tight supplies. And we got a slide later on as well, just highlighting how much that market has moved from contango for a number of years and now into quite a steep backwardation.
Let's talk a little bit more about precious metals and why they're underperforming here. Because as you say, on one level, the narrative about governments, you know, spending a lot of deficit spending, printing money, debasing fiat currency, sounds like it ought to be really good for precious metals. Of course, it is easy to see that if you look directly at the observed values for real yields, they're increasing. This baffles me, Ole, because, yeah, I get it that gold's enemy is increasing real yields. But it seems to me like inflation is just lagging. And I would expect the market to look beyond this or look across this and say, look, you know the inflation's coming at some point. That's going to offset those real yields. Gold's eventually going to move up. You'd expect people to be, you know, buying the dip a little more aggressively. They're not. We're really seeing these real yields drag gold down hard. Would you agree with the way I've described it as to what's going on, or what am I missing here?
I don't think you're missing anything, Eric, and we have the firm belief as well that inflation is coming and it is going to be higher than what the market is currently anticipating. But it also means that we got break-evens now, 10-year break-evens, just around 2.2%, and that could easily be a lot higher in 6 to 12 months. So it seems like it is just the market, they need the confirmation in order to respond to it. And also, we know also how hedge funds, they react to many hedge funds. They trade primarily on momentum and technical signals. And we obviously have we've been in a downtrend now since August. So there's nothing in the price right now that's telling a fund to get back in the market. So they're sitting on the fence waiting for the breakout. And I think a lot of these, they will, I worked for a hedge fund in London for 10 years before I returned to Denmark in 2008. And I mean, we would miss the bottom and we would miss the high, but we would get involved when the signals were right. And right now, there's absolutely no buy signal in the gold price, and we probably need to see it probably from this level, maybe even $100 higher before that start to emerge. But I think the narrative is the key driver still are two. It's the real yields and it's the dollar. And the big discussion right now is really, and we've been talking about this in our notes recently, that we probably needed to see some pain before the gain, because we need to see yields rise to a point where the FOMC starts to blink and potentially start to talk about some kind of measures to cap the upside on yields. And obviously, if that happens right at the time where inflation starts to pick up, then obviously there's only one direction for real yields, and that's back down again. So I think the market didn't like the speed of the change that we have had over the past week. We broke a key level, 1760-65, that old band, and that basically just attracted some additional selling. But we haven't broken any major level right now. I think the big line in the sand for me is the 1670 to 1690 area. That's both the local lows we had May and June last year, but also it's 61.8% retracement of the whole rally we had from March up to August. So that really is a key area that needs to hold for now.
And if we were to see a close below that, if we were to break below, say, 1680, what would that tell you? Does it mean the floodgates open and we're all the way back down to 1350? Or what do you think happens at that point?
I would doubt it, because I still firmly believe and still see a reason for holding commodities, holding precious metals in a portfolio. But it will, obviously, from a technical perspective, further delay recovery and potentially also obviously lower the eventual peak that we then will reach. But it will attract some additional selling. But I think on that basis, we also just have to remember that, as I mentioned, hedge funds, they have been cutting back exposure since almost since August last year, and their lens now is down to, I think, the lowest in almost 2 years. So the position that potentially needs to be adjusted further is not as great as we've seen in the past when we've seen some major breakouts.
Now, the alternative explanation that some people have put some stock in is, look, what's really going on with gold is all about Bitcoin. What's happening is a significant number of investors who are concerned about fiat currency debasement, who previously would have invested in gold, are choosing Bitcoin instead or other cryptocurrencies. Have you guys done any analysis? Do you have any way of measuring whether that's going on? I mean, it sort of sounds plausible, but how do you measure that? Do you think that's what's happening?
I've heard that for a long time now, and obviously it is a very valid discussion. I just struggle to see Bitcoin as you can't call it a safe haven, but a place to park your money, because the volatility is just simply too great. When you see 30% moves up and down in no time, that basically means that it is, I think, from someone who wants to preserve their wealth, it just simply is too volatile. But no doubt it's attracting a lot of attention, and if you are a paper investor, not a physical investor in the gold market, just looking for direction, then silver comes into that category as well, being a high beta gold. Then clearly the Bitcoin or the whole coin area has offered great opportunities, but boy, also a lot more volatility.
Let's move on now to the green revolution. Certainly with the shift to the Biden administration, we've got a clear message that there's going to be more focus in the United States on something that, frankly, the rest of the governments around the world were already focused on, which is climate change and, in general, being more environmentally conscious. Moving on to page 5 of your slide deck now, what does this mean in terms of commodities? Which commodities will benefit from a green revolution?
There are several of them, and we can start with the most quirky ones. Obviously, the rare earth metals, they are still going to be in strong demand, and that potentially could become a geopolitical punch bowl over the coming years. But the one that obviously has attracted most of the attention and most of the imagination from investors is copper, because it is the metal that's required for the whole electrification process. We've seen China obviously come up with a 2060 plan for that area, and we're still, Europe is already en route. We still wait to see what comes out from the Biden administration, but there is obviously a clear expectation that the demand for copper towards that transformation is going to pick up over the coming years. And from a copper perspective, it can't really, or from a price perspective, it can't really happen at the worst time, because the pipeline in terms of new production coming online over the coming years is pretty weak. And that basically means, and we're starting the year 2021 with inventories already at very low level for this time of year. So it is a market where there's a lot of potential for higher prices, and one where we are probably likely to see a new record price. It is also, of the metals, probably the one that got the biggest amount of liquidity. Also, basically meaning that it's one that's, from a speculative perspective, has become very popular. We saw just recently news from China that one of the big whales out there accumulated $1 billion worth of copper in just 4 days after the Chinese New Year. These positions obviously does create some nervousness if we are seeing a short-term pause or consolidation in the market. But so far, copper has taken the we've seen a small correction this week, but so far, just like oil, we haven't come close to break any key levels, and something like copper could easily drop 10-15% and still only just return to the uptrend that has been put in place since March last year. So there is still probably in the short term some risk there if we continue to see yields move up, thereby seeing volatility move up both in bonds and in stocks, that could trigger some period of deleveraging, just like we saw last year. And obviously deleveraging at this moment in time could potentially have an impact on some of these commodities where there's been quite a lot of pent-up demand from speculative investors.
Speaking of speculative investors, let's talk a little bit more about copper in that context. This is a tough one for me, Ola, because on the one hand, I couldn't imagine a better bull market argument than we have right now for copper in the long term, because we've got to accept that this electric vehicle revolution is real, and every single electric vehicle needs something like 10 times more copper than a conventional vehicle takes to produce. What most people don't even consider is that we really are going to need to rebuild the entire electric distribution grid in order to charge all of those electric vehicles. That's more copper. And we're also contemplating infrastructure spending for the sake of stimulating the economy. That's more copper. You just couldn't ask for a stronger argument. But boy, you couldn't ask for a more crowded trade either, could you? What are you telling clients? Is it too late to get in on this? Do you wait for the pullback? I mean, I've been waiting for a big pullback. There haven't been any big pullbacks.
I think at this moment in time, we are urging caution because what's happening in copper or in some of the commodities where fundamentals are sound, but just the outside markets, because commodities are not an isolated island. Because these days it's not just purely producers and consumers that meet to discuss prices. There's a lot of so-called paper demand involved as well, and these are impacted by developments elsewhere. And we saw that over the past week here, that after the bond spike, that we have actually seen some mild profit taking hit the market. I think there's still a risk that we haven't seen the end of the rally in yields just yet. And on that basis, urging some caution here. And as you also said, could easily see it. It could drop quite significantly without even changing the bullish uptrends that we have had in place since the low last year.
Ola, you mentioned rare earths earlier. I'd just like to clarify, what is the reason that you see it? Is it because of their use in windmills and electric motors, or why do you see the rare earths as being so important?
It's a component that's used in so many different appliances, and from, as you mentioned, from brakes in terms of very, very powerful magnets to the arms industry as well. So the thing about rare earths is that they're not actually that rare, but no one really wants to refine them apart from China these days. And that means that the rare earths are being produced around the world but shipped to China in order to be processed. And that has obviously given China quite a big say in this market, one that we are starting to see potentially breaking down a little bit. A couple of new major companies has been established over the past year. And obviously I live in Denmark. Greenland is part of Denmark. And I think there's going to be an increased focus on Greenland. Trump obviously offered to buy it a couple of years ago, was turned down by the prime minister. But I think there's going to be a lot of focus on Greenland from a rare earth mining perspective.
Returning to page 5, what else in terms of the green revolution should we be thinking about in terms of commodity trends?
I think two other metals which I like and which we obviously follow quite closely, and that's silver because of the solar panel, and then also platinum because of the increased regulations in terms of emissions from vehicles, especially recently in China. And that's and we've seen platinum as a major winner since November, where it was trading at a discount of around $1,100 to gold. Now that discount has narrowed to close to $500, and there's even the potential for that discount to evaporate over the coming years, because again, demand staying robust. One thing is industrial, obviously. Another one is financial paper demand. Then we have to look at the supply side, which is quite limited, primarily deriving from South Africa. So platinum, I think, is the reason why it hasn't really caught on that well is because it's just a tiny metal. It's a factor, multiple factors, smaller than the gold market. It's smaller than silver, and it basically means that it is one of those trades where when it gets too crowded, you want to get out the door. It's simply too small, and that creates some volatility. But just like palladium had a phenomenal run in recent years, it looks like the time has now switched to platinum, and there are emerging signs that some of the producers, they are of the emission control systems, they are starting to switch to platinum. So platinum is one. Silver is again from the increased use of solar panel together with the investment demand, which has also been quite strong over the past couple of years.
What about battery metals that are used in producing electric vehicles?
They will be part of it as well. I tend to focus primarily on the metals that we can trade. Some of them are a little bit more quirky, but any metals that is used in this in the electrification process and in batteries clearly will be continue to be in demand until potentially the new discoveries are made within the battery or new battery technologies are found. But for now, as we say, we can't turn green without getting the stuff some stuff out of the ground first.
Moving on to page 6, this is the slide that scares me a bit, Ola. It reads, hedge funds have accumulated a record long exposure. I hate to say it, but hedge funds are kind of known as the dumb money in the commodity business. Usually when they accumulate a record long exposure, it means the market's topping. Is that the case here?
Well, it's most certainly a signal that they're looking for even higher prices, and I think the phrasing the dumb money is clearly because they're always the one having the biggest position when the market turns. They are the most exposed on the long side when the market suddenly flips around. But obviously, what we have to remember as well that their hedge funds, they trade on momentum. They're looking for the big moves, and having been long since aggressively since August last year, that they have obviously reaped a lot of rewards for that. So they will take some pain if we do see a correction. But I think also it means that the pain threshold for many of these positions are quite substantially lower than where the current market levels are. So we need to see, I think, a major change in the technical or the fundamental outlook in order to rip into that long. But I think the one that potentially you could be most worried about is the agricultural position, because what we have to remember is if you want to produce more copper, it can take you 5 to 10 years from the decision is made to copper is coming out of the ground. If you're having a strong year in terms of crop prices, farmers, and anecdotally, I'm a farmer boy myself, grew up on one, and if we had a good year and we had a good production, we didn't go on holiday to Mauritius, we bought a new tractor instead. And that basically, because we want to constantly improve the production, and that basically means we could expect, weather permitting, a strong response in terms of crop production this coming season. So I think the next few months, as we enter the U.S. Planting season and the growing period, that could be quite critical for the agricultural space. So that's probably the one that because of the cycles are so much shorter, that could potentially be most exposed.
And on page 7, you're saying that this cycle involves broader exposure than previous buildups. Why is that? What is it that's getting exposure that wasn't getting exposure before?
Well, I think we can just combine slide 6 that we just talked about and slide 7, because this is the table I produce on a weekly basis based on the data from the CFTC. And if you look back in the previous spikes we had in terms of positioning from funds in 14 and 17 and 18, it was primarily driven by the energy market, a strong build-up in energy exposure. But this time around, we can see that the agricultural space is really participating quite aggressively. I think we're close to a record long if you look at some of the main, or basically the crop commodities that are agricultural commodities I'm highlighting in the table here. But if you look down in the net, which is highlighted in with the red line, you just see we've got long positions across the board. It's not that often we don't see one or two or more commodities where there's a net short held, but the driver has just simply been so strong that we're seeing net long positions across the board. I think also we have to remember that a lot of investments are handled through investment funds, ETFs, which buy into some of these major tracking funds, tracking some of the big providers of commodity indices like the S&P GSCI and the Bloomberg Commodity Index. And for every dollar invested into these, that money obviously have to be spread out across the whole sector. So if you are seeing strong index buying of some of these commodity index funds via the ETFs, it will have a positive impact on most of these commodities.
Ola, let's move on to page 9, because I think you're making a really important point here about roll yields. In a contango market, as we had in crude oil after the crash, boy, you really have to believe in the market in order to invest in the front month contract, because you're losing ground every single month as you roll that contract forward. You get a worse and worse price. Now we get a better and a better price as we move into structural backwardation. How is that? I personally follow the crude oil market most closely. Is that happening across other commodities? And what does it mean in terms of, I would think it would bring more confidence and more investment into the sector?
Absolutely, Eric. And I think we just, if you just go back one slide to slide 8, let's just basically highlight what has been going on now for the past 6 months across the commodity space. You're absolutely right. We come out of a decade where we've seen ample supplies almost across most commodities. We have had pockets of tightness, which has led to brief periods of backwardation. But generally, it's been a decade of plenty. basically, we had a massive bull run during the first 10 years of this millennium, creating a lot of excitement about the sector, a lot of investments going into the market. And as supply suddenly started to be beefed up, the demand growth that didn't catch up with the increase in supply, and that led to almost a decade, at least in the last 6 years, where we've seen ample supplies, and that's reflected in the curves, because as people normally say, the curve doesn't lie. If it's in backwardation, it does indicate that that someone is prepared to pay up to get immediate delivery. And looking at the left-hand graph on slide 8, you can basically see how the roll yield, if you take just, it's kind of non-scientific, but you take the average roll yield of 25 commodities, excluding natural gas, because it's a bit of a beast on its own. But for the first time last year, the end of last year, you can see that the average roll yield moved into backwardation for the first time since 2014. That is a major change, and it is one, if you are a passive long investor in commodities, you would have been suffering for the last 6 years from negative roll yields. But now we can see it's basically jumped to at least a decade high. We are close to 5% that you get as a passive roll by holding a long basket of 25 commodities for a year. And if you look on the right-hand side, we can see where the big changes has occurred. The light blue is where we were 12 months ago, and the dark blue is where we are today. And you can see for now the big change has really been in the agricultural space, especially the soybeans and corns, where we are now suddenly looking at roll yield returns of more than 1% on a monthly basis. A year ago it was hovering around negative 5%, but generally there's not that many commodities left where we don't have a positive carry on, and that really does matter. And that takes us back to slide 9, as you mentioned, Eric, with the roll yields. Because for the past 5 years, if you just look at the spot contract and you look at where the spot contract is trading today relative to 5 years ago, well, it doesn't look too bad. But you obviously have to remember that these contracts, they have to be rolled on a monthly basis. And with the contango in place for so long, you have basically been rolling yourself out of money. And that basically means that the Bloomberg Commodity Index, which is a bit more broad, we can look at that a little bit later. It has, you can see the gap there of around 40%. And a gap of around 45-43% on the S&P, which is a bit more heavy in energy, and that has now started to turn around. And if I had a broader chart just for the last 6 months, we could see how suddenly that it started to they started to reverse.
Ola, some of our listeners, myself included, are commodity traders who trade the futures markets directly, but that's not for everybody. One of the things that may not be clear to our listeners, I'm not sure from this slide on page 9, is what this chart is really telling you is that whole business about how, you know, commodity traders tell you, don't buy the ETFs, you get killed by the contango, don't do it. Well, it's changed. Buying the ETFs is a good idea now when you have structural backwardation. So for people who are not trading the futures directly, which ETFs, how do you pick one? Let's take a look at page 10.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. There's no doubt that the market structure has changed and suddenly it's no longer a drag. But it's also important to note that there are many different indices out there, but I've just highlighted two of the biggest that's being tracked, being shadowed by billions of dollars of investment from funds around the world and through ETFs in the most regions. But what you have to be aware of is that the S&P historically has always been very weighted towards the energy sector. You can see that on both on the pies and also on the chart on the left, that on the right, that the energy sector is some like 54% of the total exposure in the S&P GSCI. That is obviously important, because if you are an energy bull and you think that's where the biggest pull is going to come from, well, then that's the one you should look at. But at the same time, you also just put a few more eggs in your basket just to spread your risk a bit. So that could be a good idea. But if you are more inclined to look at the first of all, looking at those where we've seen this big move towards backwardation and thereby roll yields, and you're also looking at I would say a broader inflation hedge, then it's probably the Bloomberg Commodity Index that you need to focus on, because they have they're set up to in order to more or less track 1/3 from each of the main sectors: energy, metals, and agriculture. And if we, for instance, as we talked about the green transformation, if the metal space is really going to be where a lot of the focus is going to go into continuously, also from the fact that the metal space is not, you cannot just bring supply back online. If prices go high enough in the oil market, the shale oil production will increase, no doubt, because it's just, there's money to be made. But the metal space will be the one that's least reactive to increased demand, and that means that's probably where the price potentials are the greatest. So just be aware that there are different compositions, but that also means there are different ways to earn, that they can serve individual preferences.
Let's move on to page 11, because I want to come back to this question of precious metals and real yields. I think our listeners understand from previous shows that real yields are super important to precious metals. What's been baffling me is it feels like the market just can't see what to me is obvious, which is, yeah, real yields are increasing because nominal yields are increasing. The nominal yields increasing with no inflation ain't going to last. It's going to change. But it seems like the market doesn't want to look past what's in front of us right now. How do you make sense of this? And what do you think comes next? How much longer does this real yield induced temporary cycle down in gold continue?
It will, until we start to reset our inflation expectations, or we start to see yields break high enough in order to force some kind of response from the Federal Reserve. Because as you can see on this one, on the slide here on the right-hand side, the yields are, the nominal yield is a factor, is the sum of the inflation and the real yields. And what we have seen over the past year or so, even longer, that break-evens has slowly been creeping higher to reflect higher inflation expectations going forward. But over the last few months, it's almost plateaued. And during that time, that means basement as nominal yields rose, it was real yields that had to give, and they were rising almost in line with nominal yields. So we need to see so it's all about inflation. If we're, whether we're right or wrong on that inflation is going to be play a bigger part than the market is currently pricing in, I think the what could really turbocharge the precious metals would be yield curve control. I think there's a lot of arguments for and against. One thing is that Australia go in and Japan go in and cap the upside on the yields, but the world's reserve currency and the US, I think that it's basically, if they're capping yields, they're almost giving the government blank a check to spend, because they're going to keep the yields financing at prevent financing rates from moving higher. But at the same time, I think it's too early for yields to move dramatically higher. So if we do see some kind of an attempt to curb yields, then real yields is likely to they're likely to go lower. If our expectations for inflation, that inflation will be higher than where we're seeing it right now, if that comes to fruition, then that would be your next move in gold, and potentially that could be 3, that could be 6 months out in the future. So I think gold right now is very much a patient game.
Now let's play devil's advocate and look at the other side of this, of how we could be wrong here. Let's suppose that somehow you and I and a whole lot of other smart people just got this inflation call completely wrong, and we're just going for deeper deflation. I suppose one side of the argument would be, well, that really spells bad news for gold, because if you saw no inflation at all and yields continued to back up on a nominal basis, well, that would really just do a number on the real yield. The other side of that, though, is, well, wait a minute, if you really saw deflation, then this backing up of nominal yields would probably reverse. Is that a safe bet, or is there a scenario where this really turns sour for gold?
I think if we are wrong on inflation, then the reasons for having a portion of gold in your portfolio is starts to be reduced, and that could have an impact. But I think at the same time, if it's happening in a scenario where yields just continue to move higher, do you really want to be long bonds, where you're losing capital? You obviously will get repaid your full investment, but if from an investment perspective, continuous rise in yields is really not an environment that you, as from an investment perspective, is going to gain much from during that period. So I think the risk is obviously there, But looking at the tightness that we're seeing in across the world, and obviously commodities are up a lot. Freight rates are 3, 4, 5 times higher than they are normally. There's a lot of congestion. There's I think we are just literally weeks, if not a few months, away from business starting to pass on higher prices to consumers, because they have to go somewhere to pass on the cost. We're seeing PPI rising in China. China's being a major exporter of consumer goods, will have an impact as well on price pressures. So yeah, it is obviously healthy to be the devil's advocate, but it's just very difficult to see a scenario where inflation is not going to move higher and potentially even surprise to an accelerated extent.
Moving on to page 12, copper prices have more than doubled since their March lows. And hey, the pandemic's not even over yet. Once the pandemic is over, does that mean we're headed toward a triple?
I suppose there's always there's the old saying that the best cure for high price is a high price. The question is if that's still valid. If when it comes to something like copper, and if you look at where it's used, I suppose in electric car manufacturers, they can, even though it's the price goes up, it's still a relatively small part of the total cost of the car, but how much further it can go? Well, it really, if we are having a major supply deficit, then in theory, the price can go a lot higher, and most certainly not rule out that we're going to eclipse the record highs that we saw in 2011. I think the biggest risk to copper in the short term is probably China, because we're seeing some weakness in some of the data. Credit impulse is slowing, and that could indicate that we may not that the impact of the massive spending that they did last year potentially starting to fade a little bit. I put in on the slide, you can see the copper and its relation to the Chinese renminbi. So if we do see a period of renminbi weakness, so that potentially could also just take the top out of copper and create that pullback that you've been looking for. And we have to remember if you look at China, that they consume roughly around 50% of the global mined copper, and they probably hold around 5% of global reserves. So they are obviously a key driver. But I think that what will carry copper higher will not be China. It will be the electrification of the world, which will see to an increased extent both in Europe and in the U.S.
Moving on to page 13, green transformation and its relationship to correlations in commodities.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a quirky one, because again, you can always find a chart that suits your narrative. But I think this one is quite interesting. This is just basically looking at the copper gold ratio relatively to 10-year bond yields in the U.S. And you can see that to me is pretty much a correlation that has been playing out for the past 10 years at least. I probably could go even further back, but what we noted since the low last March and accelerating during the past 6 months is how we've seen a dislocation. First of all, copper has been rallying faster than gold, so the ratio has been going higher, but at the same time, it's also rallied faster than the pickup that we've seen in U.S. yields. And the question is really whether that is due to the green transformation, that we are seeing a shift in demand patterns for copper, which basically means that it can command a higher price going forward relatively to the two other assets that it did in the past. Or it could just basically be telling us at this stage that it is too high relative to gold, or yields need to go even higher. So obviously there are three variables here that could move. I think the scenario that could be really quite fascinating would be if we see some kind of a yield curve control, because then the yields will stop rising. At the same time, we potentially could see the copper gold ratio come down, because gold will start to reclaim some of the lost ground. But for now, there's a dislocation indicating that either copper is too expensive, or yields are too low, or we basically have a new world where the green transformation is going to cater for much more copper demand than we've seen in the past.
Let's move on to my own favorite topic of crude oil. Boy, you know, it seems to me we're almost up to 65, spot 65, which was the kind of double top at the end of 2019 and then January of 2020. I'm not sure if we break through that, what's next? There's not a whole lot of obvious resistance levels up there. What do you make of this market? Are we nearing a top, or are we just beginning?
I think we're nearing a near-term top before we eventually moving higher again. I think the fact that we have rallied almost 30% since Saudi Arabia cut production back in January, that obviously highlights the importance of supplies being kept away from the market. So the rally we've seen so far has been a supply or lack of supply driven rally. Now, obviously, we expect that it will be replaced by a demand driven rally going forward once we all get the COVID cloud start to lift and we can get back on planes and back in the cars and start to be more mobile. That's obviously the narrative at a time where, as well, the US producers are more suddenly have become more responsible, more interested in passing money back to the investor than just going all out on drilling's craziness. So that's I think that's the narrative. But I think we also just have to see this. There was quite a significant amount of demand from Asia during the past 6 months. I've read a few reports now over the past 48 hours that some of that demand is starting to. They're seeing slowing demand from Asia from refineries there. We're seeing India contemplating lowering taxes on fuel because prices are just simply starting to get too high. Inflation is getting uncomfortably high. So we are already at these levels starting to see the potential impact on some of the major consumers around the world. So, but I think the narrative that we are seeing a return in demand to where we came from a bit more than a year ago, that's going to hold truth, because even though we see the green transformation and electric vehicles and so on, we still have a growing population in parts of the world where demand growth is where most of the demand growth is coming from. So it will still take a number of years before we see a peak in oil demand, and into that we are seeing a U.S. shale oil sector which has become a bit more prudent than it's been in the past. Lack of investment because of the sector is just not attractive for many investors these days, and that's the whole ESG. That's something that's impacting mining companies as well, that the availability of finance is not as great as it has been. That will eventually drive the price higher, but I think there is I got a bit of sound skepticism at these current levels, and as you can also see on slide 14, we clearly need to see a more optimistic view coming in from OPEC, IEA, and EIA. Ever since August last year, they've been downgrading their demand growth forecast for 2021 on a monthly basis down to around 5.5 million barrels of growth this year. And as we recall, OPEC Plus still has around 7 million that they can unleash onto the market. Not strong growth in the US, so that will still be below the previous peaks. But generally, I think the rally in oil, potentially not a much further rally at this time, is I think it's going to be a little bit more difficult to come by. But as we move into 22, I could easily see it move higher.
Ole, you mentioned agriculture previously. Anything you want to add here on page 15?
Just what I've mentioned before, that we've gone from years of plenty to tightening supply. The one-year rule is now that across the agricultural sector, that's really where you find the biggest role. We also find the biggest speculative long. So I'm just, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a bit cautious for the coming months because we are getting into a massively important planting season in the U.S., which could really set the tone for the prices into the summer. But we're starting the year on a very strong footing.
And uranium, a subject near and dear to many of our listeners' hearts. The price of the URNM ETF has more than doubled since we first discussed it here at Macro Voices. What's going on?
I think the realization that we can simply not move to a less carbon-intensive energy supply without uranium. Wind and solar is obviously an important part of the mix, but we need some baseload, and that baseload is really sorely missing. We've seen that in recent incidents, and that basically means that I think uranium is becoming less of a bad word that was back when I was young in the 70s and the 80s. The technology has moved on, so I think it will come back. We're already now seeing quite a big growth in number of new reactors, primarily in Asia. But I think what is pretty certain is that if uranium or U-308 stays at these current levels, we're going to run into a massive deficit because it's just simply not profitable enough for the mining companies to beef up production. So I think uranium sector is one that I want to have an exposure to over the coming years.
Ola, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Before I let you go, though, we have a broad audience here, mostly institutional family offices, high net worth investors, but there's also a retail component. You guys are one of the most respected commodity advisors in the institutional space, but I believe you also have some retail offerings as well. Tell people how they can find out more about what you do at Saxo Bank.
Well, for those of you who doesn't know, Saxo Bank is basically a platform. We offer access to more than 35,000 markets or tradable products around the world. We got clients in more than 170 countries. So we operate in multiple legal jurisdictions and in multiple languages. And if you want to follow us from the strategy team, we are all relatively active on Twitter. You can find me at Ollie_S_Hansen. And otherwise, if you could take a look at analysis.saxo. And if I should just highlight two daily publications, it's our podcast where we try to stick our neck out on a daily basis, just what's moving and where we see the market go next. And also just a quick take that we put out early in the European hours, just to summarizing what's been going on overnight.
Well, Ola, I can't thank you enough. Patrick Serezna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Monetary and fiscal measures by governments and central banks are inflating asset prices globally. As investors prepare for future inflation, demand for scarce real assets is rising. How does the 1% prepare for this? They invest in art. Masterworks.io is the first company that lets you invest in multi-million dollar paintings at a fraction of the cost from artists like Basquiat and Keith Haring. 84% of ultra-high net worth individuals collect art, according to a 2019 Deloitte survey. And it makes sense. According to Citi Private Bank, contemporary art returned 13.6% year over year in the last 25 years versus 8.9% for the S&P 500. Over the same period, art had the lowest correlation to the stock market of the 10 major asset classes. Masterworks.io is making art investing accessible to everyone, regardless of accreditation. Start diversifying your net worth today. Visit Masterworks.io to learn more. See important information at Masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, what a great interview with Ole Hansen. You know, I really learned something when he talked about the term structure, and because I've always assumed that with futures that you're always going to have a negative carry when you're rolling on these contracts. But the fact that the term structure is shifting and the fact that you can now actually invest into these commodities without that drag is was something that was just caught my attention. What did you take away from the interview?
That's a really important point, Patrick, and I think that for our listeners who are not futures traders, when you hear me and lots of other people say, look, don't try to buy the commodities through the ETFs because you get clobbered with contango yield and it just wipes you out. It's not a good plan. Don't do it. That's all changing. And the question is that commodity in structural contango or structural backwardation? We got so used to everything being in contango that we just assumed it was. Now, as things move into backwardation, that actually means you make a roll premium, not a roll cost, but a roll premium every month. You're buying the same commodity for a slightly lower price as the ETF rolls its positions forward. So for commodities that are in backwardation, the ETF suddenly make a lot of sense. Let's move on, Patrick, to the post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, the title of this deck is Markets Get Wobbly. Boy, no kidding, especially the stock market this afternoon. What's going on here?
So Eric, the story up until now has been rotation. And we've heard Julian Brigden talking about the impact on those FANG stocks and other growth names with higher yields. And really what we have seen is structural weakness in those growth names and rotation into those energy, cyclical, financials, and so on. And that's been the story. It's held up the Russell. The S&P has more or less, the correction has been contained. And almost all the selling has been in the NASDAQ. And one of the things we were asking was, will that be it? Is this just going to be like a NASDAQ-driven correction? Or is this get into something bigger where there's a broader liquidation cycle or liquidity event that happens on the short term that drives a deeper correction? What's interesting is the S&P on this chart too is only down about 6% from top to bottom, and it's just breaking below the 50-day moving average. A 10% market correction in the S&P, which is not uncommon to have, well, you know, typically even once a year in the markets, could see the S&P drop toward 3,500, where all those previous highs are. But if we go to page 3, this is the interesting part, is that the NASDAQ has already surpassed a 10% correction, and we've already done a 50% retracement, and we've already now come back to retesting those September-October highs. And so this is a really interesting moment. Is this really a bigger kind of traditional correction that happened in the NASDAQ and the S&P was just dragged down with it? Or is there a more ominous drop coming in the NASDAQ in this rotation and the S&P will come down to that 3,500 level? This is such an interesting moment to determine that. But really, there is no denying it. The NASDAQ is where the relative weakness we've seen, so much selling in ARK and all of the EV names and so many of those bubble stocks that have really got all of the money flow earlier are now in very distinct profit-taking cycles. And what I wanted to highlight on page 4, 5, and 6 is just picked three of the FANG stocks, Apple, Amazon, and Tesla. And we can see they're decisively all below their 50-day moving averages, very decisively being distributed on the downside. And it's really going to be interesting to see, like, is this just one of these one-month corrections and this is all a buy and dip on these FANG stocks? Or is there something much deeper in store for them? I mean, can we see Apple, like Julian Brignan was talking about, do a 50% correction off of its high if yields are pressing 2%? Boy, is it an interesting moment in the markets.
Well, Patrick, I think this is all strong evidence to support a story we've been talking about for months, if not years, here on Macro Voices, which is this market has become entirely about the Fed and Fed-supplied liquidity. And what's going on here is everybody was expecting that the Fed would continue to support the markets. We saw all-time high after all-time high after all-time high. Now, today, when Jay Powell didn't say what he was expected to say and didn't allude to Operation Twist version 3 and so forth, all of a sudden, people are starting to panic. And I think that what happens next is entirely dependent on the Fed. The most likely outcome, my guess as to what happens next, is Jay Powell pulls another rabbit out of his sleeve and says, okay, folks, we're going to do, you know, whatever it is, Operation Twist or who knows what. Market participants are reassured, and before we know it, we're powering back to yet another all-time high. If we go the other direction, particularly if the Fed were ever to make a statement and say, look, bailing out the stock market is not our job. We're not going to worry about what the market is doing. We're going to let the market find its own level. We're going to focus our efforts on other things in the Main Street economy. I think you'd see a crash start instantly if they ever said that. And for that reason, I don't think they're ever going to say that. But moving on to page 7, Patrick, what is next for the reflation trade?
Well, you know, Eric, I wanted to really just have this conversation with you because I kind of look at the markets today and I ask, what is the single most consensus view out there? I think you'll agree that it's the idea that inflation is here. And there's really been this cycle where everybody's rotating into these commodities and resource names and everything. It's such a crowded consensus trade, a consensus dollar down, consensus everything. And while that view probably will be correct in the years to come, often what happens when a market gets overextended and so crowded in one way, often the market checks that rally and we see mean reversion and corrections and a lot of the weak hands get shaken out of these trades. And I ask the question is like, can this crowded trade be broken or shaken? And so on page 8 is an interesting chart from Pavilion that is showing the China credit impulse. And a lot of people today are anchoring off the Fed balance sheet and off money supply CPI and all these other inputs that are showing that in things that are inflationary. But at least over the last decade or more, it's really been the China credit impulses that has driven many of the commodity cycles that have driven the those inflation impulses and the reflation trades. And what's interesting is we have seen a turn in that Chinese credit impulse. And I haven't heard too many people talk about this. And I just want to ask the question, I mean, could this potentially be what lets some of the air out of this balloon and where we could see some of these different counter trend moves occur where some of these markets correct? And so when on page nine, I have that US dollar index, and we were just talking about the idea that the US dollar, which has been in a very clear bear market, and it's only been in a range for the last few months, but this has been consensus. It's consensus that the US dollar is going down. And again, it probably will over the next couple of years. But what if we do get a US dollar squeeze here and this goes higher? That would certainly be some of the first warning signs, like a canary in the coal mine, that some of the air might be taken out of this reflation trade. And I think with that US dollar, I also have the US dollar against the renminbi on page 10, which is also showing that huge US dollar downtrend that's been very well in place since the second quarter of last year. And for the first time, we're seeing it sort of taking a break, and it's kind of turning up. And I don't want to already be touting that some new uptrend is emergent, but it's really interesting that this moment in the markets that we're seeing a lot of these warning signs that would typically come at this moment.
Well, Patrick, and as you say, the dollar is really going to be interesting to watch. I want to see what happens at 92. Yeah, we're kind of getting close, 91 spot 63, as we're speaking Thursday afternoon. That's just about exactly where the high print of the day back on the 5th of February, which was the previous high, was. So we're just back to testing what happened a month ago, or a little more than a month ago. We're not really into, you know, moving to a high yet. We're on the edge of it, but let's wait and see what happens. Closing print above 92, I'll be convinced, okay, now something's up. In any event, let's move on to the Bloomberg Commodity Index futures chart on page 11. Looks like maybe at least a short-term top was put in there.
Well, Eric, what I wanted to talk about is this, the commodity index. We heard Ole Hansen talking about it earlier. And really, what we've seen, even though crude oil has punched to a higher high, we've seen so many of these other commodities already kind of put a short-term top in everything from lumber to copper to many of the grains. They have had these amazing bull runs, and they've really driven higher. And we really are seeing at this moment where this almost like broader risk-off impulse is happening, where the dollar's slowly creeping higher. Equity markets are backing off, and many of these commodities are putting in some of these short-term highs. And it'll be really interesting to see whether or not we do get just a natural market correction in this advance, and certainly be watching where some of the buy on dip opportunities may emerge there. But what I wanted to really leave off here was on page 12, just to show that where we stand on the 10-year yield. And what we continue to see is that the yield keeps pressing higher. And I think one of the big warnings signs that I'll be looking for is will we see some short-term blow-off in this 10-year yield that kind of has it start to mean revert back downwards? And right now, it looks like it wants to try to punch to a higher high, and I think that needs to be our base case at this moment.
And finally, on page 13, folks, don't forget, you can get Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading, every single day for 14 days, 2 weeks, with a free trial. Information on page 13. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Patrick, what can they expect to find in this week's research roundup?
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Ole Hansen's slide deck, as well as the chart book we just discussed in the post game. There's also a link to an article, Albert Edwards and Scott Minard Agree That U.S. Yields Can Go Negative, and a link to a Jeffrey Snyder article, Reflation Amplitude is important, but what about frequency? So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email, containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.